February 12, 2003. I'm at the home of Jack Evans, 806 Main in LeGrand, and this is our second session with Jack. We wanted today, last time we talked a lot about the architecture of what's now downtown LeGrand, and we wanted to begin today by moving towards some discussion of Old Town LeGrand, up around B and C streets in that area. Jack, would you like to give us just a brief overview on Old Town and then maybe talk a little bit about if there are still any buildings surviving up there that are original structures?
Okay. The Old Town area was, during the emigration period, was campground for the people in the wagon trains. Mill Creek was handy, and there's a level bench up there where they camped. But it wasn't until 1861 that anything was done about settling it. In the fall of 61, Daniel Chaplin and a couple of other fellows, I believe, staked out a land claim for him, and he told some others who spent the winter here, the first to do so, that in the spring he'd come back and lay out a town. And he did that. He came back and laid out a town on part of his claim, which was the first settlement of LeGrand. And it's typical Roman east-west, north-south grid. However, it's 3 degrees off, and still is, because they didn't compensate quite enough for the deviation of the compass. So it's at a little bit of an angle, and I'm told that the people who have surveyed lots up there in order to get people title to them have had quite a time trying to compensate for the crooked lines. Anyway, the original town was pretty well bounded by A through D, or E, streets, and probably first through fourth. At the upper end, around first, there are other streets now beyond it, and Ben Brown's cabin, which was the first one to be completed, was at the corner of B and Cedar Streets. So that's a little bit beyond where the regular grid is. But anyway, the original town occupied approximately that area, and of course it grew some over the years. B Avenue was the Oregon Trail, and the stables and warehouses and things of that sort were on the trail. And the principal business street was C. Everything else was residential. And there was an 1875 photograph that, with buildings in it identified by somebody who knew what they had been, which is quite interesting. And one of the business buildings is still standing. It's a false-fronted building that's a dwelling now, but it was, I believe, the tinsmith shop. But the town itself is pretty much, I would say, there's almost nothing up there to suggest that it had ever been a business area. Everybody eventually moved down to the new town. The road going west, I should say a little bit about that, when it was still the Oregon Trail, up to 1860 or a little better, it went on up the draw behind the end of B Avenue, and along the bench, and then straight up over the ridge behind Table Mountain. And the wagons that went up there, some of them had to have as many as 18 oxen hitched to them to get them up that steep climb. They couldn't go side hill because they would tip the wagons over. But the government in 1861 finally honored one, I think maybe the only one, of the things they had agreed to do for the tribes in the area, and this was to build a road around the south side of the reservation so that the immigrants wouldn't be tracking across it all the time, bringing disease and other problems with them. And they did that. The old road leaving LeGrand had a switchback, you might say, installed in it, so that instead of going straight up, they started a little further to the south on the bench and went up the mountainside at an angle. If you know where to look, the traces are still there, but they're very faint now. Beyond that way, it followed the Oregon Trail pretty much across the ridge and over onto the plateau, which is north of Morgan Lake. And the old road is quite visible across there going west, partly because it had been the Oregon Trail and had become a freight road where everything went, supposedly, that didn't go by the stage road. Meacham Brothers Toll Road was a stage road across the mountains, and that continued to operate. They were not handicapped in that way, but it was a toll road, so most of the emigrant travel and a lot of the freight went the other way. But that road was only in use for a few years. At the point east of Oran, several miles, where the Oregon Trail went down the slope to Hillgard Park, as it is now, at the point where it turned northwest, the government road turned southeast and went down the draw and went across another flat that is now south of the Grand Ronde River and eventually intercepted the river a ways to the west of that. It was not a very good road. I understand that it crossed the river 19 times and eventually wound up over a pilot rock, but it was only in use for a few years. After that, Foster had taken over Meacham's station after Harvey Meacham was killed in 1872. He married Meacham's wife later on. He had worked for them, and he managed the toll road and built another road of his own, the Foster Toll Road. So by 1868, the road had been extended all the way down the Grand Ronde Canyon to the Grand Ronde Valley. And after that, the old road across the flat up above was just discontinued. It was such a terrible thing to travel anyway. They didn't use it anymore. It was used, I think, by people to get up on top to herd stock and this kind of thing. And for a little while in the 70s, there were some mining claims up there, and people used that route to get up to them. But it was not a very good road. The road that came into La Grande after they reached the valley was came through Oradell, which was right at the mouth of the canyon. It's underneath I-84, right at the mouth of the canyon. There's nothing left of it all, though you can see a couple of foundations on the hillside, I think, to the north. But the road then came along the western edge of town. The part of it that still survives is Sunset Drive. And at the upper end then of C Street, where you came to the business district and went east along it. 4th Street was extended to the north. I'm not sure how far. In 1884, of course, it was run all the way down to the new town.
So the big change that occurred, obviously, was the arrival of the railroad in 1884, which was the impetus, and we talked about this a little bit last time, was the impetus for the building of the whole new town, right?
Yes. Right. Yeah, there was nothing down there. There might have been a farmhouse or two, but there was nothing really down there where they put the railroad. Mm-hmm. And since it was all on Chaplin's land, and he had donated the land to the railroad, some of it, and released some more for platting as a town, all of the platting was and sale of properties was taken care of by some firm in Portland that he engaged. And there was a lot of speculation that people would buy up lots and then resell them and so on. But the speculation period didn't last too long. And the town got a pretty good start by 86. There were quite a few buildings. And when the fire started in the back of J. Brooks's clothing store, general store, on August the 4th, it ate up the whole town, all 7 blocks of it, plus the new railroad depot.
I know we mentioned some of the fires last time. That must have been really quite an occasion when that happened.
Yes.
Could I ask you about buildings that might be surviving in Old Town? You mentioned that there's one false front building on C Street.
Mm-hmm. On the north side.
What about...
That was the Tim Smith shop, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. Most of the buildings up there are some of the houses that do go back to that period, but they've, of course, been modernized and altered in various ways. The the level place where Wilkinson's mill, flour mill, stood, is still level. There are houses on it. The early part of the town at that end is up Oak Street, to the head of Oak Street. And that photograph was taken from up there in 1875. You can't get a shot from that particular spot now because there are pine trees, young pine trees are sprung up and are in the way. But John Turner and I did go up and look at that, and you can see where the buildings were that were there. There's nothing, the little corner place that was a corner grocery years ago and is still on the corner of 4th and C, dates from a much later period. It was a neighborhood grocery from the 30s and 40s, I would say, and into the 50s.
Yeah, so that was probably, that particular building would date maybe from the 20s or so.
Looks like
a lot of those buildings.
It's in that general style.
Yeah. Well, so when the town then was platted then in the 18, the new town was platted in the 80s, and then the construction of the city, at both the residential and the business areas of the city, as we know it today, began at that point, right?
Right.
So... what would have been the population, approximate population of the old town before the railroad?
You know, I don't know. It wasn't a very large town, of course. I am not sure that... it seems to me I have seen some figures somewhere at some time, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I really don't know whether I have or not. The new one... its population increased pretty rapidly, and of course after the fire it was rebuilt immediately, partly in brick. And then after the fire of 1891, which wasn't very long after that, then they built almost exclusively in brick and other fireproof materials. The one interesting thing about it is that Adams Avenue only went as far in 1892, I think it was, 89, let's see, 89. Adams Avenue only went as far as Fir Street. And the old Ron Valley House, which had been under several other names and was put up in 1888, was a big hotel and rooming house. It was on the corner of Fir and Adams, and it extended right across the street to the south, and the gable front of it faced south. So that it had to be turned around when they did run the street on through to where it would face west. And there are photographs of it showing it in both positions. I think they must have turned it around rather than torn it down and wrecked it and rebuilt it. They moved a lot of things. We think of this being the day and age when you pick up a house and move it. In the old days, it was a lot slower, but they didn't have any phone lines or power lines to take down, so they managed a little better. And some of the big ones were moved. The store that stood on the corner of Washington and Depot, that's the northwest corner of the intersection, where the Reynolds building is now, was a big two-story mercantile store, general store, with a gabled front that faced east. And that building was moved down from Old Town. One of the illustrations in... Stearns's Tour of Union County from 1882 shows a picture of it, as it was up there. But it was moved down there. That was W.J. Snodgrass's store, and he was the principal merchant at the time.
Mm-hmm. This book by Stearns you mentioned before, what was the name of the gentleman again?
His name was Doran, D-O-R-A-N-H, Stearns.
And it's Stearns,
S-T-E-A-R-N-S. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a journalist, and printer, and evidently a lithographer, and a fairly good amateur artist. And he traveled over the state and wrote up what he saw and the people that he met and talked to and advantages of the area. Part of it was promotional, and it carried some advertising. The one for Union County, which included what became Wallowa County later, was... quite interesting, and it really gives a good picture of the area as it was then. Mm-hmm. His lithographs are interesting. The towns do show the buildings about where they were, and other things, and they're the only thing we have from that particular period. This was immediately before the railroad. One of the pictures, the one of the area where Perry is now, shows a railroad tunnel and a bridge, and he said that's just approximately where it would probably be located in sometime in the next year or two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it didn't exist at that point, yeah, but it was coming.
He said the right-of-way had already been cleared, so it seemed like it wouldn't do any harm to illustrate it.
You know, I wanted to ask another question, speaking of building. The initial, going back to Old Town for a minute, the original residences in any case would have been probably logs, right?
The very first ones. They had
I wanted to ask about a sawmill. In other words, I didn't know about a sawmill.
Well, there were several, I think. The one that's mostly known is Charles Fox's mill, which was up on Fox Hill. And it was certainly one of the early ones. I think he started it in 63. But there must have been some others because they brought an awful lot of timber out of Deal Canyon, Robert Deal's claim, and some of it was firewood, of course. They had to have firewood to burn, but there was a lot of good timber up there, and it looks pretty good today, too, but then this was 150 years later. But the... there probably were other mills around that I don't know about and that I haven't seen listed anywhere. But the demand for timber, of course, has been pretty great. But the very first thing they would have done, probably, would be to get a sawmill established. And then it's very labor-intensive to hew logs, you know.
By hand.
And hoist them into place and so forth. And with boards, you could build very rapidly. And the type of construction they used in those days was lots faster and simpler. It certainly wasn't weatherproof, but it was lots faster and simpler than the later types because these were simply boards stood on end with a batten up the joint, and then a 2x4 across the bottom, across the middle, and across the top. There was an old house up in Old Town. It's torn down now. It has been down for quite a few years, but maybe clear into the 70s, I think that building was still in use. It was just a single wall house. All the door casings, door frames, stuck into the room a good 4 inches, and the space in between them was just the inside of that wall. It had been covered with wallpaper and other things years ago, but nobody had ever furred it out and put anything on the inside, which they sometimes did with those. And so in winter it was a mighty cold house because all the wind blew right through it. It was a pretty house, but it was not a sound one. And they used that for a long time, and it wasn't until the 80s probably that balloon frame construction became generally accepted around here.
So for those first 20 years or so, you would have had single wall construction.
Quite a lot of it.
What about a brickyard? Would that come later?
Not too much, because Aaron Sommer, who was one of the early merchants, put up the first brick building in LeGrand, and this was prior to 1882. There was a brickyard here until quite recently, and I think most of the deposits came from the same area. It was right around the mouth of the Grand Ronde Canyon. And the Jensens had it for a long time. But there was a brickmaker in early LeGrand, and I think he is mentioned on one of the real early directories. There aren't any city directories, but there were regional business directories. And any town that had anything in it usually advertised in the thing or got themselves listed because otherwise, there wasn't any way they could have any advertising. That was the only kind there was. So, there's a neat one for 1867 is the earliest that shows LeGrand. And in it, by list several people. But there was a bricklayer mentioned in one of the early ones. And that may have been the fellow that put it up. But Sommer did put up this brick building. That was in association, I believe, with Leopold Bayer, another early merchant. These were fellows all out of Portland, I think. And Sommer and Bloom was another arrangement. He was with other people. That was his store in LeGrand. And then he had one over in Somerville, which was Sommer Brothers. Daniel Sommer was his brother. And they were Jewish, I believe, and well respected. There was never any animosity toward them at all. But many of the merchants at that time were Jewish. But Sommer, he didn't, I don't think, move down immediately. He must have, though, because while it isn't mentioned specifically that he lost his building in the 1886 fire, he did put up another one immediately, a brick one, and that was the first brick town in Newtown, brick building in the new town. And he...
And what was the year on that again?
That would have been 1884 when he built that one. 86, excuse me.
Yeah.
It's 86 or 7, right after the 86 fire anyway.
Because when they had the 86 fire...
It burned again in 1891.
But they were all frame buildings when they had the first fire in 86.
Yeah, and I think he had a brick. I think he had a frame one down there too, because he built the first brick one after the fire, and the second brick one he built in 1891 following that fire is still standing. It's been remodeled quite a bit, but it's a Sommer building. It's still there.
I wanted to ask you about the name Sommer, the town Somerville. It's a different name, different spelling.
Entirely
that has
different.
Nothing to do with the name of those people.
No, it Sommer is S-O-M-M-E-R. That was Aaron and Daniel. And then Somerville was, it's described in Reagan Geographic Names. And if I'm not mistaken, the man who first put a building there, named the place after a friend of his in Salem named Alexander, I think, Somerville, S-O-M-E-R-V-I-L-L-E. That he, of course, spelled it Somerville, which people would remember. They wouldn't think of the other spelling.
Right. Yeah, that's very interesting. You know, I wanted to see if we could move to a couple of other areas, and then you might possibly want to say some other things too. Let's pause for just a moment, though. We'd like to turn for a few minutes to early day newspapers in LeGrand and Union County, and you wanted to discuss, there were two early newspapers you said founded in the 1860s. One was a Democratic paper and one was a Republican paper. These would have been in the late 1860s?
1868. They were both first printed in 1868. The very first one was the Blue Mountain Times, which was a Republican paper published by Makaja Baker, an attorney, and George Coggin, businessman. I don't know very much about Baker. Coggin was killed during the Bannock Uprising over near Pendleton in 1878. July 12th, I think. But the paper was printed on April 18th, and was the first one. In later years, there was a story told to the effect that there was a race between that paper and a Democratic rival, each one trying to be the first to get their paper on the street, and that the first one hit the street about 3 or 4 hours ahead of the other one, and the Democrat paper was the first one. However, the Democrat paper, which was the Sentinel, was actually 2 weeks later than the Republican paper had been. That story was told by the fellow who printed the print Sentinel, E.S. McComas, an interesting character, who probably should have a book written about him because he did so many things. And what he did was often kind of fascinating. He came out here in 1862 and wrote one of the better diaries of the westward journey. He and the fellows that he traveled with spent a winter up at Auburn working in the mines. And then and he took a wagon all the way to Vidalis and back to get provisions for their winter stay. And then after the settlement era started in earnest, well, he became part of the LeGrand business scene. He was always an entrepreneur, or a busy man, but you put it that way. He was one of three fellows that got the first drugstore established in LeGrand. He operated a hotel for a while. He hauled wood part of the time. He became, I think, Register of Public Lands for a while. He did all kinds of things. But starting the newspaper gave him a good outlook for his personality, which was a little flamboyant. And during the 1870s, he agitated pretty strongly for a war of extermination with the tribes of the area, particularly the Nez Perce, because he felt that over in Ohlau County they stood in the way of progress. He didn't hate them at all. He just thought they were in the way. And he, I think he was influential to some extent because he blew some areas out of proportion and exaggerated others and said a few that weren't so. And there was a delegation, I think, to the legislature from that area insisting that something be done. But anyway, it all came to nothing, fortunately, and the Indians, Chief Joseph and his people, crossed the Snake River into Idaho, and that was the end of that particular scare. But he wasn't just a yellow journalist in the Hearst sense of the word, although the two fellows would have understood each other perfectly, I think. But he didn't mind doing a little bit of sensational reporting or editorializing. And his stuff is often colorful, and he had a lot of news, and the paper was quite a lively one, and I think for its time, pretty good one.
How do you spell his last name?
McComas, M-C-C-O-M-A-S. Mm-hmm. He had three last names, Evans, Smith, McComas. No wonder he went by E.S. He was always known as E.S. to everybody. But he was a character. And he published the Sentinel for quite a long time. When the county seat was moved in the election of 1876, I believe it was, 74, he moved along with it. And he went to Union and published the paper over there because that was where all the business of the county was transacted for a number of years, quite a few until 1901. But 1904, actually. 1901 was when the county boundaries were redrawn, and then LeGrand knew that around the next election, it would get the county seat. He tried before a time or two and didn't make it. Anyway, McComas finally retired, and I think that was about 1882, something like that. And after that, he did all kinds of things. He was always involved in promotions of one kind or another and traveled widely, usually with two big valises full of interesting things, like one of the people who had written about him said, chairs in mines that should be there and aren't, or chairs in a lake that might have medicinal properties, lots in towns that hadn't been built yet, and this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Usually came home, he must have been a pretty good talker, because he usually came home reasonably wealthy, but the money disappeared quickly, and so he had to go back on the road again. But when he came home, the first thing he did usually was to go down to the jail and bail out any Indians that had been arrested for drunkenness or anything like that. And he often brought strays home with him. That is, I think one was Chinese who had been stranded somewhere, and he came along and was cook for them for a while. He did help people. He was an unusual and interesting man. Finally, this I think was pretty much toward the end of his career, he got into patent medicines, and one of his friends was Chief Whirlwind of the Cayuse Nation, who went with him, and they did the medicine show circuit for some time. His line was Whirlwind Remedies. So he always dressed himself up in a fancy Western suit, kind of like Buffalo Bill Cody wore when he did his show. And Let's see. He did a lot of other things too. But that's about. Just looking for the date when he died. It was after the turn of the century, I believe, and he died over in Wallowa. But I'm not sure of the date of his death. Somebody should write a book about him. He had nieces, and I think those were the ones that started writing. One of them, in a writing class in the 1930s, wrote several versions for her memories of him. Lightly fictionalized, but obviously taken directly from life. And they are kind of fascinating. Most interesting personality.
We were going to, you wanted to just had a couple wrap-up comments on Mr. McComas and like I think the date of his death.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to say was that the Republican paper that was printed before he was didn't last very long.
That was the Blue Mountain Gazette? The Blue Mountain.
One moment. Blue Mountain Times.
Blue Mountain Times.
The fellows that ran it were no match for McComas' personality.
What was the name of his paper?
His was the Mountain Sentinel.
Yeah, the Sentinel.
Yeah. And became just the Sentinel later on. Then Run Sentinel. He was quite a character. And he died in 1911 at the age of 72. He was living over near Wallowa at that time. And he was one of those people that, he was just regarded as a character. And I think very much a character.
Well, were these papers weeklies initially? Were they weeklies?
Yeah, they were all weeklies.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The first daily was one of the LeGrand papers. And the Observer tried a daily paper pretty early, and I don't think it took. But later on, they went to a daily, and it's been with us ever since. They were, one or two others in LeGrand tried it and failed. Mm-hmm. There just wasn't enough demand. But the, evidently, once you get it, it's like one of those things where you create the demand by providing the item, and sometimes it works that way.
But yeah, by providing the service or the opportunity. And of course, with a larger business community, there could be more advertising.
Right.
So on, and you could gradually make it pay, I would think,
mm-hmm.
for the daily.
Yeah, the Observer started in 1897, I believe.
Was that the Daily Observer?
That was the weekly.
That was the weekly.
Yeah, that was when it was first started. Not where that is, but it's all listed in the essay that I did, which was printed in the Observer a while back, several years ago. 1896. Mm-hmm. October 20th, 1896.
Then that was for the Observer.
That was the first Observer.
Okay.
And the Daily was introduced November 1st, 1901.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, just a little over 100 years ago.
Yeah, the Daily was initially a morning paper,
mm-hmm.
and then switched to evenings in 1903.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's been as it is today,
mm-hmm.
Essentially, mm-hmm. for a long time,
mm-hmm.
well over 100 years.
Well, the technology has certainly changed. I would imagine the technology of those early papers was pretty much handset type, particularly those early weeklies.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been handset type. The linotype machine came in later in the century, in the 80s or 90s, I think.
Yeah, the very early ones probably were just the printer had a type font, you know, and a simple press with an ink roller.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know when Mergenthaler's machines. There was something, I ran across something about that. They came along fairly late, and I believe the Observer had one about that time, around 1900.
Yeah, I think they were available by then. By the turn of the century, they were pretty common. But before that, I think it was pretty much handset stuff.
Mm-hmm. Those printers were, they were kind of a different breed of people, you know, mm-hmm. and they, if you read up on the old newspapers, you keep finding the same names. over in Willamette County. Here's a guy that was working out in La Grande a while back. And they just moved around. And the ones that tried to run a paper in a town the size of Flora or Somerville, they had a very uphill battle. Mm-hmm. And they had to be doing it for the love of the art. They really had to love newspaper printing and publishing. Like to see their work in print. And some of them certainly couldn't have made more than an absolute bare minimum living at it. There was one paper. Excuse me. I have a an issue, the only surviving one, of the Somerville Annotator. And the only reason it survived is because the the paper hadn't been delivered, that is, the stock hadn't come. It was late in being delivered, and the deadline for the paper was due. And the editor printed the paper on butcher paper that he got from one of the local butchers. And it's much better paper than the acid newsprint of the day, so the paper is nice and crisp and rattly and still in pretty good shape.
That paper didn't survive long, I take it. I mean,
the acid paper, it starts to decay just about as soon as it's printed. And the old newspapers that have survived this long are crumbling, most of them. Mm-hmm. And they're as fragile as you can handle them, really. The Observer had a complete file, pretty much, in its vault. And in the last years, when they were in the old building, the staff kept using the old issues to put interesting items in the current papers that they took from the old ones. And by the time they were ready to move, the bindings were coming off and the papers themselves were disintegrating into loose sheets and pieces. And they tried to move it to the new building, and I guess up on the top floor there is still a pile of them up there, but it's mostly just a pile of dust. The papers don't survive.
Yeah, that's too bad. They have disintegrated. Did the Somerville paper itself last very long? It's probably not. Huh?
No, not very long, and I think it was all in 1890.
Just in 1 year, really.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I don't think it survived much longer than that. I've written down what the information there is about it, but it didn't last long. Like so many little towns, an effort was made to print a paper. Lostine had a paper. It had a rough time, too. And at some point it was combined with one that covered some of the rest of the area and this sort of thing. But small towns, Wallowa had a paper, and I think it was fairly well supported. Had a paper from 1911, I think, with the Wallowa News, and then at some point later became the Wallowa Sun. And the Sun lasted until 1944, I believe it was. The editor got bent out of shape over something or another with the people of the town. Probably didn't feel they supported him well enough. He moved it to Enterprise. And then later, well, I had another paper. It was the Wire Record. And it was published by a couple of fellows who also published a paper in Elgin.
Well, you grew up in Wallowa County, correct?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
In the town of Wallowa.
So you were actually from Wallowa?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, nice place to grow up in. I enjoyed my life over there.
Let's, for a few minutes, just talk about drugstores, Jack. You're working on a project right now doing some research into early drugstores in La Grande. Do you want to talk for just a few minutes about that first store, and then anything else you want to say?
Yeah, okay. I did I did mention the first one. I'm sure it was the first one, because three people combined their resources in order to get it started. So there must have been a pretty fair demand for it. The three people involved were a man named Hulsey. He was a doctor. And Deal, that would have been Robert Deal, who for whom Deal Canyon was named. He was a man of several occupations, as most of those people were. He was a farmer. He had a livery stable, rented horses, and that sort of thing. And he was a butcher. So he was a businessman in town, too, in a couple of ways. And then the third person was E.S. McComas, who at that time was, I think, Register of State Lands and operated a hotel part-time and did several other things. So anyway, their combined efforts got the first drugstore going. It was a few years later, I think it was Halsey and Mahaffey, it seems to me, that he had taken in a partner, and it was apparently a going concern. But many of the early drugstores were established by doctors, which is a logical thing. They used a lot of medicines, and this would be one good way to get them, keep them all in one place, and maybe sell some of them on the side. So having a drugstore was a good idea. Another local doctor of the 1890s, really, 80s and 90s, was E.D. Steinkamp. Dr. Steinkamp, at one time, had the drugstore in Granite, up in the mining country.
When was that drugstore in Le Grand by Deal and so on, McComas and so on, when did they found it?
1867.
1867, so that was quite early, and it would have been then in Old Town. It would have been Old Town somewhere.
Yeah, 1862 was when the town was was planted and settled, the first part of it, and 5 years later, they waited a little longer for a drugstore maybe than some towns did, but obviously there was a need for it with the three people backing it.
Was there another drugstore, a competing drugstore? Did that come in at any time?
None of the old directories that I've consulted show one. And there aren't very many. I think there's 1867 and then maybe 71 and then nothing until about 1881 or 2. And there's a 10-year gap at least. But by 1883, the drugstore in Old Town was operated by Joseph Palmer. And when the new town was established, he moved to the new town, and the drugstore then became Newland and Palmer. Ferdinand Newland, I believe it was, that was the other person involved.
Well, in those days, didn't doctors make up their own prescriptions? In other words, wasn't the doctor really the pharmacist in some of those early drugstores?
Indeed he was. If there wasn't a drugstore, he had to make his own pills, anything that he couldn't order from some firm. And, of course, if you needed a medication in a hurry and it took you a month and a half to get it, the patient probably didn't survive long enough to try it out.
Right.
So they almost had to have a supply on hand, I would think. And if they did, then if there was enough time on their hands, why, they might have had a store at the same time.
Right, and they would sell other items in the store. Once they opened the drugstore, they would be able to sell other items, patent medicines, I would assume, things like that, huh?
Yeah, there were a lot of patent medicines in those days. Mm-hmm. And before the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906, some of those medicines were quite effective. There were little problems involved. For example, soothing syrup for babies worked like a charm, but it was mostly laudanum, which is the same as opium, and not all that good for the child in the long run.
Yeah, wasn't laudanum occasionally opium and alcohol as well? They'd mix some alcohol with it, I think.
Yeah.
I heard that.
Paregoric was one of those. And there were various of these concoctions. The thing that made you feel better, usually in the patent medicines, the bitters and so forth, was the alcohol in them.
It would kill the pain. Whatever pain you were feeling would probably go away with the alcohol.
Yeah, you felt very pleasant.
And and the opium, too, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Would be.
It would indeed. So that was... too many people were becoming addicted to things like morphine and opium and so forth, simply because medicine worked and they took it. And so the government had to apply some standards, which they did in 1906. And since then, medicine has been a lot safer. And the patent medicines that were mostly alcohol and flavoring with a little bit of grass or something in them to give them an herbal appearance, those were, some of them were quite harmful, really. And so they were able to get some of those things off the shelf.
But in the early days, that certainly would not have been true. So in the 1860s and 70s, early drugstores could have sold the any number of things without a prescription, really.
Yeah, it would just be whatever was available.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a lot of things, and this was true clear up until World War II, they had a lot of things that they don't any longer. You could buy almost any chemical you wanted through the drugstore.
Mm-hmm. Like arsenic, for instance.
Well, arsenic, or I was thinking of things like things used in woodworking, actually, various dyes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Logwood extract and alkanet root and all those things were used to color various finishes. And all kinds of, there were a couple of things that were used for browning steel, mercuric chloride and other things. You could get those.
You could just walk in and buy them over the counter, right?
Yeah, if you need so much of this, I've got a blew a gun, I need this particular thing, or rat poison.
Yeah, I'd heard. I remember that things like arsenic could be sold without any questions being asked.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell them you were going to use it for rats or whatever, and they'd sell it to you.
Well, arsenic came in very handy sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Lafayette C. Baker, who was something of a charlatan and not altogether honest, was head of the Secret Service during Lincoln's administration. And afterwards, he swore that he knew an awful lot about various congressmen and other people that had been involved in the assassination plot. And he died of arsenic poisoning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It would be interesting.
Yeah, it's like the CIA.
Mm-hmm. Interesting to know, get the full story on that one.
Yeah. Different century, but the same idea.
I was going to ask you another health-related question that we could think about just for a moment as we wrap up. I wanted to ask you if you wanted to say anything about an early hospital in Le Grand or hospitals.
The first hospital that I'm aware of, and I would imagine some doctors at certain points were like, the doctor over in Malawa when I was growing up. They had a building, like a fairly large house. The upstairs was were rooms for patients up there, and he conducted it kind of as a hospital. And it was called the hospital, too. He had his offices on the ground floor. But the And Le Grand, the only one I know of that's actually called a hospital, was Grand Ronde, which was established by three local doctors in 1906, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The Grand Ronde Hospital. I would have to look up their names. Dr. Molitor was one of them, and one associated with him that wasn't involved in that, Dr. Lincoln, was a dentist. I think one of the Richardsons was another of the doctors. But anyway, there were three of them that there was a need for a hospital, so they established Grand Ronde. And that was the first one here. When St. Joseph's Hospital was established, seems to be it was 1935.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The idea of a hospital was certainly prevalent during the 80s and 90s, particularly the 90s, but getting one going was a different matter, and we didn't get one until 1906.
Yeah. And of course, in terms of babies being born, most babies were born at home anyway, were they not? In fact, they were all
often
pretty much
midwives
born at home.
Were the ones that took care of that.
Yeah.
If the doctor had a nurse and he made her available for that sort of thing, then it was a little more formal.
Mm-hmm.
And if he operated a hospital facility of some kind, then people were there. Hot Lake, the building in Hot Lake, I believe, was 1906, 4 or 6, and it was designed by the same architect that designed the administration building at Eastern, Dennis.
This is the existing building.
The existing brick building at Hot Lake.
And the name of that architect was
Dennis, B-E-N-N-E-S.
Mm-hmm. I have heard that.
Yeah, he went on to Portland and designed buildings down there for various places around the state. And one of them, I think, was one of the first reinforced concrete structures in the state. But much of his work was done for the system of higher education, buildings on various campuses.
Mm-hmm.
But that was when that was building was put up, the idea was that it was to be a sanatorium, and it was just a hospital and curative facility. You could go and take the waters and recover from whatever. And it had also a hospital, and they have surgery, operating room, and everything. So it was a fully equipped hospital and quite busy, one of the best in the country, it was said at the time, up into the 20s until the time of the Depression. So it was an important early hospital for this area.
Jack, I want to thank you for both of these interviews. These have been very helpful, very complete. We certainly have a lot more ground that we can cover, and hopefully we'll be able to get back soon to consider a couple of other areas. Did you want to add anything today, Jack?
I don't think so. We can just try something else again.
Sure. Well, thank you, Jack, and we'll get back to this. Thanks.